Hey, a quick note on this episode. At one point, we mentioned that A Hard Day's Night was released before the Beatles appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, and that is not true. Beatles appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show a few months before the movie was released, and we incorrectly mentioned the opposite. So, yeah, just so you know, that's a pretty big error to make, so it sort of colors the conversation a little bit. But now that you know that I know that I'm wrong, maybe that makes up for some of it. All right, enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me on the other side of this call is James. You can check out our website to keep up with our most recent podcasts. We recently talked about Punch Drunk Love. Before that was Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker. And before that was our Christmas episode, Home Alone and the Night Before. And before that was The Last Action Hero. So yeah, you can check that out, themacguffinmen.com. And yeah, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
Do we do Home Alone 2 in the night of the inevitable sequel to...
So you mean the night of starring Riz Ahmed?
Yeah.
Sure. I'm not going to watch Home Alone 2. I'll just guess at what happens. I remember there's a Trump cameo, and they make another one of those old-timey gangster movies. I feel like everything else is basically the same, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Podcast landed. All right. What's our topic today, though?
Today, our topic is A Hard Day's Night, the movie, and not the song or the album.
Exactly. Although, it's kind of all three.
Yeah, I suppose it is. Have we done a lot of like music like this? I mean, The Last Waltz we did.
Yeah, but that's also a documentary. This is our first like and we've done a Josie and the Pussycats podcast long ago, but that's more like commenting on musical stardom. This is our first musical movie, like narrative musical movie starring musicians, as far as I can recall.
Yeah, and this kind of walks the line a little bit. It's a bit of a documentary, but it's obviously not real, but I feel it goes for that angle. It's somewhat a concert movie a little bit, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a jukebox musical in a way, right?
Yeah, there's also, I feel like there was probably more music in movies like this from the same time, though, because it doesn't feel, like a lot of music in this movie, but not a lot of actual performance in this movie. Whereas I feel like the idea of there being less than, it feels like a third of this movie is them with their instruments performing. And that's like at most. Whereas I feel like most, when I think of movies from this time, most of which I have not, have not even seen. I've seen a bunch of them as a kid when you're just sort of like scanning television and they used to play movies like this more. But, it felt like there was more music involved, and I don't know, this feels like more of a movie to me than a lot of, or than what I had in my head, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I don't think it comes close to a third. I mean, we get them on the train doing one song and it's not even a whole song. And then we get a bit of a medley near the end of their television taping, but.
And a little in the rehearsal as well.
Right. But oh, yeah.
It basically depends on if you count the long dance club scene as a musical sequence.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a Beatles movie, so there's going to be music throughout it. But it's not a sing their feelings type of musical. You know, it's all very diegetic when they're playing music. It's mm-hmm. because they're a band that plays music. When you mentioned similar movies around this time, I think the biggest one has to be an Elvis movie, right? Because that was, you know, another extremely popular musician who wasn't really an actor. The Beatles are a lot better actors than Elvis was, even though he wasn't as terrible as you might think. Mm-hmm. And his are more, you know, seeing the feelings, kind of loosely structuring a story around a couple of his songs and trying to make those lyrics fit. And when they can't, just say Elvis is singing a song to impress a girl or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is an interesting one because, as you say, this is more of a movie. You probably feel the same way about this movie that a lot of people reviewing it do, that it's a bit more inventive than it really needs to be, considering the kind of movie that it is. And this is closer to the Elvis comeback special than it is to Jailhouse Rock, you know. So the kind of jukebox musical has been around for a bit, and so I think this benefits from seeing a star like Elvis do it pretty straight down the middle and having a bit more fun with it. And I think Richard Lester has kind of proven other spots in his career that he does interesting things. And I mean, Steven Soderbergh's a big fan of him. So you can imagine that that's someone who doesn't just paint by the numbers.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I mean, Richard Lester directed a movie that won the Palme d'Or, not his film after this was The Help, or was Help, sorry, not The Help with Emma Stone. That was a Tate Taylor special, I think.
Help, which is just another Beatles movie.
No, that's what I mean. Help is the other Beatles movie that Richard Lester directed. But after Help, he directed The Knack, which won the Palme d'Or. And yeah, Soderbergh has a book of interviews about Richard Lester, which you will not be surprised to learn I have read and enjoy. Yeah, and he, you know, he was just sort of, I mean, he's not dead, but he hasn't directed in a long time. But this movie feels like a French New Wave movie. It's crazy. Like,
yeah,
it's so cool. Like, I enjoyed this movie way more than I expected to. Like any human being, I like the Beatles. I was surprised at how I basically everybody but Paul, who I expected would make me laugh because I've always sort of felt he has good comic timing. I was surprised at how enjoyable the other three Beatles were to watch. And I was very interested in the filmmaking in this movie, which is never the mindset I'm in going into a movie built around pop musicians and like selling them as a brand. That's never what I'm expecting to get out of it, you know? Like, I mean, I didn't see that Katy Perry documentary. I can't imagine it was stylistically inventive, you know? Whereas this, it felt cool, you know? It was a cool movie. I enjoyed watching it.
Yeah, and I think that...
And it's funny, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But we talk about, you know, those jukebox musical movies and a director or writer, just their names just frequently don't come up. And if they do, it's just kind of, you know, to shepherd something through production, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But this is a movie that, you know, people knew that a Beatles movie would do something and make money. I mean, it's kind of funny that it's interesting. This movie is kind of an afterthought and that they just wanted a way to get the soundtrack out in the States before the British label could release it. Did you see that?
Yeah, yeah. So United Artists, by making this movie, had the rights to the music as a soundtrack, and so they were trying to rush it out so that they could beat it before EMI, who I believe had the publishing rights for the Beatles in the US, could put out the Hard Day's Night album.
Is funny, and I think that's interesting that this movie didn't really have a huge budget. Not that movies like this do, but it didn't have a big budget, and they just approached the Beatles, it seems, and gave them a list of directors and say, what do you think of these? And they seem to have enjoyed the running, jumping, and standing film that Lester had made, and particularly John. And they picked him out. And yeah, this really could have been, you know, as I said, a paint by numbers kind of movie. You're making it for, you know, preteens or teen or low teens for the most part. Mm-hmm. And it's just way more interesting than it needs to be. And there are other Beatles movies and none of them are really regarded as well as this one. And I was really surprised by how positively critics continue to talk about this movie. And maybe nostalgia is going to play a bit of a part that I'm reading critics who the Beatles may have been a big part of their childhood as well. But even people younger than that or people who are serious film critics who you think would be better about not allowing them to influence their opinions, mm-hmm. still speak really highly of this and, you know, use phrases like the, what was it that I saw? The Citizen Kane of jukebox musicals. And it's just so much more interesting than it needs to be. And I think that it does the Beatles such a great service.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, part of the construction of the movie was built around playing into the Beatles' strengths, you know, like there's a press conference scene because the Beatles could handle doing a press conference and feeling natural, you know. Yeah. Performance scenes, I mean, that's a standard, what you were saying, like it's Elvis. Let's just get him to do the thing that he does, and we'll just point cameras at him instead of just normal eyes. But yeah, the screenwriter, Alan Owen, who got nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay, which is bananas. That's so weird. Must have been a terrible year for writing. But hung out with them for a few days and basically structured the film around what their lives were like, which is very similar to this. It's you're in a car, you're in a train, you're on a stage, and then you're on a car again. Yeah.
And not just what their lives are, but what their personalities are, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's also that
kind of a way that you could write all of these guys as just, you know, guys in their, like, British guys in their early 20s. I think it's worth mentioning that Alan Owen's from Liverpool as well, so would know them and their dialect and their attitude maybe a little bit better than other people would. But there's a way you can basically write out all these characters to be, you know, four versions of the same person. But that time that he spends with them seems to allow him to get to know them a little bit. And these aren't deeply complex characters that he sketches out in this plot. But, you know, there's the dim-witted sad Ringo, and there's the snarkier one and the quieter one and things like that. So, yeah, that amount of time with them. And the Beatles are extremely popular at this point. You know, this is still the go-to of how do we show, like, really famous people? Oh, just crowds of them running and, like, shot from the side, right? But they're not global icons by this point. You know, it's still too early for that. They could just be a peak fad, right? But this movie catches them at a point where they're not quite there yet.
Yeah, it's pre-Ed Sullivan Show, you know, which is, like, the famous moment that people will point to as being like, this is the Beatles moment. You know, at this point, they became worldwide icons. I mean, I don't know enough about the history of the Beatles to know if whether or not that's true, but that's the way that people have sort of have it in their brains, you know?
Right. Yeah. And so when you say this is French New Wave or just more interesting than you thought it would be, what gets you there?
Very little of it is shot on stages, except for the scenes where they're actually shooting on stages, where they're supposed to be on stages. Like, they're shooting on a real train, which is fantastic and just difficult because, I mean, you can see that they're clearly not able to use any of the actual on-set audio. They're looping the whole thing, and they crush the looping. Like, the Beatles are amazing at looping. Actually, I heard Richard Lester talking about this, and he said it wasn't surprising to him that they could loop so well. And looping is going back in and re-recording your dialogue to the footage that they have chosen to put in the film. Very common practice, and the further back you go back in film history, the more common it is. But yeah, he was like, yeah, but it makes sense. They're used to performing from rehearsal tapes and all these things. And I'm like, yeah, that does make sense.
yeah.
But that...
And
that,
just that being on camera altogether, right? Like, I know that's different from looping, but just being comfortable with... in a room of people all recording them and audio and just groups of people and crews, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, part of the New Wave thing is that they started shooting on March 2nd and this movie opened on July 6th. So, like, you just have to move quickly. And part of the design of the movie was it was a very documentary style sort of feel. And so much of the French New Wave style was we're making a movie with real life sort of things that happen in it. You know, like, we're not going to necessarily cut out all the mistakes and all that. Like, the guy in the train car whose hat falls off the rack, you know, and he picks it back up and puts it on the rack, like, that wasn't supposed to happen, but they leave it in the film. John bumps into a camera on the train. George knocks over an amp in one of the performances, and, like, they even add a sound effect to accentuate that mistake. so that sort of thing is cool. And also the editing is very French New Wave, especially the way that they focus on the sound of the crowds at the beginning and the end as they're being chased and as they're performing. And just the way that they edit these close-ups of faces with these whip pans and just sort of make it feel like this very, like, borderline frightening mob, you know? And that's a very sort of French New Wave way of using editing to sort of take basically, you know, take this collection of faces and cut them together in a way that makes it feel terrifying, you know?
Yeah, it's I don't know. I was still why do you think this movie's in black and white? And I think that's you talk about French New Wave is what brings that to mind. It's, as I said, those early Elvis movies that are, Jailhouse Rock 7 years before this, they are successful in color. Mm-hmm. Why is this one black and white, do you think?
I think it's still, at this point, it's for reasons that I can't articulate because I haven't done the research. I think it's still, at this point, easier to shoot on black and white. I bet if you go back to 1964 and look at films shot in any sort of documentary sort of style, it's just more common for them to be shot in black and white just because maybe color film stock, they haven't developed a speed yet that allows you to shoot with less light. You know, that would be my guess, but I can't say whether or not I'm right.
And do you think this is more appealing in a way because it isn't black and white? Do you think something succeeds, or do you think this, it just gets by despite that because of what they're allowed to do technically, having, you know, a smaller camera or having this film speed?
Well, I think given that it's this period of the Beatles where it's still like pre Rubber Soul and Revolver, which is where they really, you know, that's the beginning of when they find weed, and then Revolver getting into more psychedelics.
Hey, they didn't find weed.
Bob Dylan gave it to them. also, it should be noted the scene that the Beatles are in, I'm Not There, is very inspired by A Hard Day's Night because they're sped up like the Can't Buy Me Love scene.
Oh, yeah.
And they're being chased by a mob. Yeah, so it just sort of feels more, I don't know, his, like, as somebody who was born 16 years after the Beatles broke up, it feels more like, it feels somehow more accurate because this feels like the older period of the Beatles. This feels like the period before they found out how to make music in color, you know, where it was still more simple music. And obviously these things,
such a pop band.
Yeah. And like, obviously these things are not going through Richard Lester and the Beatles' head at this time. But you know, looking back on it now, it fits to me, you know, it makes more sense for this movie to be in black and white for me than for it to be in color.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I kind of have another reason why I think that it worked at the time and it works now.
Okay.
No, it's similar to that, but, yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense too, because yeah, I mean, as I was saying, they're just such a straightforward pop band at this point, right? Like, mm-hmm. they're just doing what was popular in the clubs at the time and just doing it very, very well, but not psychedelic and not experimental and not a lot of the things that we come to associate with the Beatles now or at the more experimental periods. And yeah, it just seems like if you had home movies around this time, they would be in black and white. You know, you wouldn't have color home video. And this just seems like a more... you know, intimate documentary, day in the life, you know, excuse the puns, style of shooting something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's definitely not why they went with this. The technical aspects you mentioned make a ton more sense. But I think if they were going for something that wasn't just, you know, Viva Las Vegas, you know, this big, flashy, artist as a spectacle kind of exhibition film, and more of a, you know, get to know them cinema verite style, this works so well. And yeah, it absolutely ties in with all the technical reasons, but it feels more of a get to know them than just how, you know, incredible and wild they are as people and as musicians.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's still like one of the things I enjoyed thinking about with this movie is that it's still sort of like, as you mentioned, constructed versions of their persona in a way that is still purporting to be like narrative in some capacity. Whereas now, when movies about musicians come out, they're not narrative in any way. They're documentary. You know, like when I think about the movies that have come out about musicians, where the musicians are themselves in the movie of this decade, I think there was one, like I mentioned, about Katy Perry. There was a like concert doc / biography about Justin Bieber probably about 5 years ago. I feel like there might have been a One Direction one, and I think we're just like way past the point of there being a narrative movie about a band. Most recent one I could think about was Spice World, which is in the late 90s. I think it's 20 years ago. And like that, I don't know. It just felt like an interesting transition in music, in that over time we've gotten to a point where it's like, yeah, we know it's construction, so we don't even have to worry about writing the screenplay anymore. And that was something like charming and old fashioned I really enjoyed about A Hard Day's Night, is that they're still sort of accomplishing the same things these modern documentaries would be trying to do, where it's like, we've got to give this person their bit, where Harry Styles gets to be the one who's like drinking tea by himself and reading books or whatever. but they do it in a way that's more documentary, whereas in this film they're actually writing scenes about Ringo being like lonely and very upfront about being the least liked Beatle, which I found like basically everything I've ever learned about Ringo has made me like him slightly more than I already like Ringo. You know, like there is like a calm and a total acceptance of who he is that just most people do not have, and I find it very respectable.
Yeah, you'd rather be the fourth Beatle than the number one non-Beatle.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you'd rather be Ringo than Pete Best, you know?
yeah, as you were speaking about just the different types of ways that musicians or musical artists end up on screen now, I feel it's the biopic, where it's not them, but it's their story. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, other than I'm Not There, which you've mentioned, it's pretty straightforward. It's childhood tragedy, you know, success, the darkest before the dawn moment, and yeah, eventual greatness, right?
Yeah.
Or if an actor is trying to get into acting, they, you know, distance themselves pretty, not very hard, but distance themselves from that career and, you know, play another type of character. Or it's just, yeah, very straightforward concert film, and this one kind of lives in a space in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there were like there are examples of movies that are kind of in the middle as well, like from Justin to Kelly, I suppose, is more like a I'm just trying to think of things that have existed in my lifetime, or at least the time of my life when I remember these things.
Crossroads?
Exactly, that was the other one. From Justin to Kelly and Crossroads were movies that are kind of along the lines of the Elvis sort of thing. Although to my recollection, there's not a ton of music in Crossroads. But From Justin to Kelly is like a full-on old-fashioned musical.
There's I Love Rock and Roll, and I haven't even seen Crossroads.
Yes, that is true. but one of the things that I really enjoyed about going back to the French New Wave thing and how that has influenced the way that the movie feels is that, I mean, the original title of this movie was Beatlemania, because the song A Hard Day's Night wasn't written until this film was already in production. Another thing that I feel like is constantly forgotten about to most people when they think about the Beatles is how fast they worked, like just unbelievably fast. And, you know, like multiple albums in a year and all these things. And, you know, the fact that the title song of this movie was not written until during production, but the fact that it was called Beatlemania and is clearly constructed in a way that's supposed to be about that, it feels like such a claustrophobic movie, because again, they're using these real sets, or sorry, real locations as opposed to sets, seemingly whenever they can. And, you know, you can really feel how close the camera operator is to the actors a lot of the time, especially on the train and the backstage area where it's so cramped. Basically, every time they were able to do a camera move, I was surprised. You know, like it just looks so small, and they're so clearly on very wide lenses. And I think that does a really good job of indicating how trapped these four guys were at the time. By like, you can't really go outside, you know, like as the first scene in the movie illustrates, it's like it's a chore to go outside. You know, how much of that was a fabrication, who knows, but like we know enough about the Beatles to know how famous they were. And I don't know, just the feeling of claustrophobia in this movie I feel is very strong. And also the scenes where they appear to be the happiest are the scenes that happen when they're like outside. Again, the Can't Buy Me Love scene where they're running around outside, or where they're in a small room, but it's huge compared to some of the small rooms they've been into. Like the hotel room feels slightly less claustrophobic, and they're like at least able to goof around and everything together. And I felt that like a very small, but I think important decision to making me like this movie as much as I did.
Yeah, we get the mirror on the wall of the train car so we can see the other faces of people talking.
I love that shot.
Yeah, I thought you might. Yeah. But yeah, just to be able to do that in an actual train car, you know, you need a little trick like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, on that note, this is not a heavy movie by any means. I mean, we kind of talked about Ringo being the fourth Beatle and he gets his time to be alone and sad, and from what I understand in real life, hungover, which is great. And yeah, the idea of them being trapped in their fame is one that, you know, it kind of bookends the movie really, and is pervasive. But it's still very light and joyful. You know what I mean? Like there's that element of them not being able to go outside, and there's this, I mean, the other kind of ticking clock, I guess, element of this is that, you know, will they make it to the taping on time? And it seems like they generally think that, yeah, they will, and if they don't, they don't really care. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really take the plot of it too seriously, and I don't even mean that as a dig, just, I don't know, though, thinking about the Elvis movies that I've seen and probably just some other movies about this around this time really do take themselves very seriously, and that this plot is sort of life or death, or you're going to lose the girl that you love if you can't, you know, win the race or whatever it is. What do you think of that? There is this narrative structure there, but we're not really adhering to this strict, you know, plot structure in a way that movies around this time that are a lot more structured and rigid in their production don't, they certainly stick a lot closer to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think part of it is that still around this time, all the Beatles still like each other a lot. and they did until Brian Epstein died. It seems to be about when things started to change their manager. Reading about their early career, it's like really like borderline heartwarming how much they really authentically loved each other, and how much they enjoyed hanging out with each other, and how much they missed each other on the like few opportunities they had to be apart. And I think part of it is that they were just people in their early 20s that really liked hanging out with each other, and also were guys in their early 20s who just wanted to joke about all the time, you know.
Yeah.
And I
and we're crushing it.
Yeah, also, yeah. Also basically redefined music and continued to for a full decade, like repeatedly. So I think it probably just has to do with the fact that the Beatles would have had a lot of control over this movie. And like, I mean, we mentioned how they picked the director from a list of names. And I think they just would have wanted to keep having fun. And also I think going back to what I was saying about Alan Owen, building the script around things that he knew the Beatles could do comfortably on camera, maybe emoting in dramatic scenes was not one of the things he saw evidence of.
Yeah. 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 That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, to that point, I think, this movie seems to be perceived as more improvised than it was. You know, there was that element to it. And certainly, you know, even the I'm not a rocker or a mod, I'm a mocker, stuff like that. Those are things the Beatles said earlier. Mm-hmm. And kind of got written into the movie. But I think the lightness of the plot that I'm speaking about, too, it's a movie for people in their teenage years. And, you know, those coming of age movies can be pretty heavy in their own particular way, but I think that it's, you know, teenagers in the 60s, I think it's supposed to be about levity and having fun. And I think coming out of the very conformed 50s in America and in Britain, they're not, you know, anarchists trying to destroy the system, but I think that there's just that they're more, you know, freewheeling and less buttoned down. And, you know, they make jokes about the war, you know, 20 years after the war. And along with kind of the French New Wave things of doing this, you know, not stealing some of the heaviness from that, but just some of the shooting things quickly and editing it in a new, fun, interesting way, and, you know, getting away from some of these forms of film. There's just that levity and that airiness to it that I think, you know, the people who speak about this movie talk about how it influenced, you know, music videos and commercials that came out and films after this, and talk about it being a, you know, kind of an auteur Richard Lester movie. But they always just speak about how fun and warm it is. And I think that that's something that is just part of the undeniable appeal of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And like the thing that I'm talking about with the Beatlemania is like a claustrophobic place to live within. All of that is, you know, not specifically discussed. I just think that the movie, despite what you're saying about it being like a very light film on the surface, I do feel like there's something, like, again, pretty slight, but it carries throughout the whole movie, that just sort of gives it more staying power. And I mean,
yeah,
it's 2018 and we're talking about it, you know, like, and how many concert films, or sorry, how many like narrative movies about musicians from this time is anybody talking about? If anything, it's this movie. And I just think that's interesting, you know, like, and I think it's not unlike the early Beatles career where, like you said, they were just a pop band, or, you know, people thought maybe they would be a fad. And over time, people are like, oh, no, these are the best musicians of all time. And we sort of start to figure out that even the early music was more intricate than a lot of people were giving it credit for at the time. And I think that's sort of the one of the ideas, like the fact that there is an idea underneath the superficial lightness of A Hard Day's Night. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, the idea that there's any subtext. And I think that a movie similar to this could have been made.
This movie's a billboard. You know, it's a billboard saying buy our album.
Yeah.
You know? But you also have to pay to see this billboard.
Yeah, a billboard for a loophole about
how to release music in a different country. Billboard that says, please don't wait for the EMI release.
Yeah, no, I think that a movie similar to this, I mean, I think we both agree that, you know, these people are just funny at what they do. You know, maybe they couldn't have had acting careers playing anybody but themselves, but they can play themselves in a very entertaining and charismatic way. And, you know, just pretty much they're not asked to do much heavy lifting, but they just hit everything correctly, right? Mm-hmm. So not to take anything away from that, but this movie could have been made about a lot, like about the Dave Clark Five, you know, or about any kind of contemporary band. But I think it's, you know, profoundly interesting that this one that has so much more to offer, when it could have been so simple, is the first movie about a band that had so much more to offer while appearing very simple at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And so something I mentioned a little while ago there, we kind of talked about how this, you know, looking backwards to French New Wave, stole a lot of things. Well, not stole, but used a lot of things from.
Not even looking that far backwards, you know, like, no, that's part of the thing that's really cool about this movie, is that this movie was released in 1964, and, you know, Breathless is 1960. That's the one I know off the top of my head. That's one of the big French New Wave movies, and that is not a lot of time, you know.
No, and just how this movie has influence from, you know, shortly after, but also seems to have left this legacy, you know, looking forward, and not just about the Beatles' career, but and not just about movies about musicians or rock music, but people speak so highly about this kind of creating almost a new grammar, and just the idea of cutting to the music wasn't something, you know, cutting to the beat, mm-hmm. as we see in the Can't Buy Me Love sequence. You know, it kind of has a bit of that Seinfeld isn't funny effect, where it's hard to really appreciate it in the looking back on something when we've seen it done so many times. But for this to offer, you know, anything new stylistically, let alone a couple things and things that have stuck around and become so central that it's easy to miss them, I think is remarkable as well.
Yeah, I mean, like, it seems, this movie seems to, and I can neither confirm nor deny this because I didn't dive too deep into the research, but like in one of my points of reference for this movie, said it like was the first movie to do multi-camera performance shooting, which seems like for something narrative, obviously live television, that would be how you do it. But for something that was narrative, like you know, they'd have multiple 35 millimeter cameras just shooting the same performance from different angles. And that just seems so, like, of course that had to be invented at some point, you know, like, but it just, I don't know. It, like, I still even now doubt it. I'm like, why didn't anybody think about that? You know, like, Why didn't anybody think gravity existed before an apple fell off a tree?
Yeah.
And that's the type of thing that I think you're talking about with the Seinfeld isn't funny. Just that so many of these ideas have been integrated into so many different elements of culture that we just can't even see parts of the influence.
Yeah. And I was completely victim to it as well. Like, I thought this was interesting movie to watch, but just like reading Roger Ebert's review, he said, talking about Lester in this movie, said he influenced many other films. Today, when we watch TV and see quick cutting, handheld cameras, interviews conducted on the run with moving targets, quickly intercut snatches of dialogue, music under documentary action, and all the other trademarks of the modern style, we are looking at the children of A Hard Day's Night. And again, I mean, maybe this, I'm always cutting all these things down a little bit by saying the nostalgia factor and just how much people love the Beatles, and for good reason, but it's hard to kind of parse these things. But for this to be as influential as it was to time out, as we said, was something that could have been so broad and plain, is just incredible. And to line it up, as I said, with a group like the Beatles that kind of did the same thing with music, is just so, it's not fortunate because it took hard work, but it's really, there's just this stroke of luck in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other thing I didn't mention about, as far as the claustrophobic sort of feel to this movie, when they do get to be on the stage, which is, you know, one of, as far as interior environments, it's the most wide open one that they're in. The last sequence, when you get that big wide shot from behind the band. Do you know the shot that I'm talking about, where they're in the foreground and the crowd is in the background? And
yeah.
The focus is just so deep. Yeah. It's just such a bizarre shot because, like, it's just so uncommon to be able to get that much in focus in a frame. And I love that shot. I think it's incredibly engaging. But it also is, like, even when they are on this big wide open space with lots of room to move around, in front of them is still just this huge crowd of people that they can't escape from, and that is somehow louder than them, despite the fact that they have amplifiers.
You know? Yeah, it's this sea off into a vanishing point, right? The sea of people. And yeah, it's, in a way, it's this big room and you're with a bunch of other people, so it shouldn't be lonely and claustrophobic, but it crosses that line where it's so many people that it's just this, it almost functions as this entity itself, right? These are no longer just individuals, the way that when Paul's very clean grandfather
just so clean
so clean is trying to sell the autographs that he's done, mm-hmm. you know, he expects a bunch of people to hand over money and to him to hand it, and, you know, he sees the scheme in his head, but it's just this mob, and it's so overwhelming. They're no longer just individuals who act like individuals. And there's this mob mentality that the Beatles of this time are facing that, you know, it's so gigantic and monstrous that it kind of transcends humanity in a way that's very frightening for the people up against it.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
Cool. anything else to say about this movie?
I mean, I feel like we've done, like, I mean, the only way to talk about it is to list things that we find in this movie that are funny. but this movie is, like, legitimately funny in a way that most comedies don't age this well. You know what I mean? Like, some of the gags are really funny. Them going into, like, a second car is, like, that type of thing is just really creative. And when they're on the train and annoying the guy with the hat that fell off the rack.
But they get outside the train.
Exactly. And, you know, and John disappearing from the bathtub, like these things that just can't possibly happen. Yeah. But they're still just funny. And I just think that, like, given how old this movie is and the fact that it is, like, when it's not a music movie, it's fundamentally a comedy. So few comedies age as well as this movie has. And
Over the Ocean, right? Like, just British people are obviously very funny people, as we know from British comedy, but comedy, just because of cultural references and changing senses of humor, you know, they age poorly. Mm-hmm. And then throw on the multiplier effect of different cultural references and a different comedic style just by, you know, national identity. It just ups the degree of difficulty so much. And yeah, those absurdist bits like outside the train and the bathtub that we mentioned are just kind of sight gags that they can get corny, but you can't really lose them to cultural references or time. Mm-hmm. This does manage to stay funny.
Yeah, it's
and maybe some good things that aren't meant to be funny, like something like he hates grooviness, that might not have been funny at the time and became funny. But yeah, it certainly bears mentioning that this does remain funny despite the obstacles.
Yeah, so much, like, I don't know, like the fact that 90% of the humor in this movie has aged incredibly well is just that is not a normal percentage for a comedy, you know.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's it. I just wanted to make sure.
That is a good point.
We did the comedy justice.
Yeah. Yeah. As you said, when it's not being musical, it is being comedy. And we talked about how it's way less musical than you would think. So, yes, it certainly nails the other leg that it stands on.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week. We'll be talking about something else.